WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We'll be looking at the Gulf War from many different perspectives in the coming days. My first guest says he feels torn apart by developments there. Mohammed Latif was born in Baghdad. He left Iraq 30 years ago and is now an administrator at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. But he has a brother and sister still in Iraq. He has 7 nephews in the Iraqi military, but friends in the American military as well. Latif says the conflict between the U.S. and Iraq has changed his life and the lives of other Iraqi Americans.
First 2 days, Terry, I was glued to TV. And the more I watched TV, the sicker I got to my stomach, because the war was turning into video game. And every time they talked, the smart bomb, the lasers and all this, being as a physicist myself, have worked on lasers myself, I begin to see the effect of this design. Then also the human side of my came, because these, I watched on the TV, these jets were taking off from Riyadh and Dahran or from other carriers, and I more and more looked at it and thought, my goodness, they are going north, and the first city they're going to counter is Basra. I grew up in Basra. My brother is there with his large family. Then they're hitting Baghdad. So B-52 were bombing the south. I said, where are they going? To my own hometown. This is the place I grew up. These are the streets will be destroyed. So it became very personal. And so finally, at some point, I said, I don't want to watch this anymore. So I turned the TV off.
So you're not watching the TV?
I don't watch it anymore, no.
When was the last time you were able to speak with any of your family in Iraq?
I spoke to my sister 2 days before the August 2nd. Was that like July, end of July? And the events were building towards confrontation at the time, and she was very upset. Then after the August 2nd, I lost all contact until about a week before the deadline of January 15, a week before I finally got through the lines and spoke to my sister.
What's the difficulty of getting through? Are the lines jammed? Is there another problem?
What they do is, during the situation like this war period, they eliminate direct dialing to Iraq. They want you to go through the local operators. And so they narrow the number of lines they can monitor. So the ingoing, outgoing calls are monitored. So they want to have a number of lines available which they can control.
So in other words, if you called them, your call would be monitored, or if they called you, your call?
Both ways.
Both ways?
Both ways, in and out, sure.
Do you develop almost a code for speaking to your family?
No. It's all understood between us. We know each other. But last time when I spoke to my sister, she was just crying, and she made a very point, my boys are in the military, they're gone, they'll be killed, they're going to die. So the conversation was mostly with her crying on the phone.
We have found that a lot of Iraqi Americans are very uncomfortable about talking now. Do you have any concerns about, I know that you're on a little bit of a speaking tour in a way. You're going to be speaking at various colleges and teach-ins. Do you have any concerns about being a public Iraqi American while we're at war?
Yes, I do. I do. As I've been speaking out for past 2-3 months, and prior to that also, but past 2 weeks intensified. So I thought if I would present as my family an Arab American, to say this war is unnecessary, so if we can stop the war before it started. So I was part of the Act for Peace group, people here in Philadelphia. I'm a member of that group, and our interest was to see if we can prevent the war from starting. And I was speaking out quite a bit into the televisions and news media, radios, and also newspapers. But past few days, I begin to feel a little bit depressed and concerned about my being out in the open, because the intensification of the war has intensified the what we call the hate crime on the street against the Arab Americans quite a bit. I was just spoke to my friends at the ADC, which is the Arab American Discrimination Committee, to see what's happening around the country, and they told me that within 72 hours the hate mail call letters and other kind of activity has increased against the Arabs. And that had put me in a spot to say, well, I am only one probably in a way speaking out. I have some other friends doing it too, but they're one or two. So that had put a little damper on my being in the open.
So even in the past few days, you've been reevaluating.
I'm reevaluating too. I'm become a camera shy, and I become discussion-wise, and I'm gauging my day-to-day how it's what's happening in the public.
Are you going to, in the next few days, try to get through by phone to your family in Iraq, or have you given up on
that? This is given up, no. I'm waiting for the disaster that I hate to think what it's going to. In other words, I'll wait for when this thing is over. We don't know when. Then we will sit back and look. The disaster has stuck, the tragedy, the death of, I'm sure, going to be very bad news. So I'm kind of waiting day to day. And I want to make a point here. I'm not alone in this predicament. Thousands of Iraqis and Arabs who have relatives there would be in this situation.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mohammed Latif is an Iraqi-American who lives in Philadelphia. We'll talk with Middle East historian Philip Khoury after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Saddam Hussein is trying to rally all Arabs to his cause, drawing on the sentiment that Arab unity transcends national borders. We asked historian Philip Khoury to discuss the roots of Pan-Arabism and the role it is playing in the Gulf War. Khoury is a professor of Middle East history at MIT, where he's also the dean of the School of Humanities and Social Science. Khoury says Pan-Arabism means different things to different segments of society. The ruling elites of some Arab nations have at times used the concept to try to broaden their power.
But there is also a more popular sentiment, sentiment that is expressed by intellectuals who may not be part of the state apparatus and people further down on the social scale in Arab society who feel a strong cultural and social affinity with other peoples, who feel that the frontiers or borders that have been established in their part of the world do not really represent their interests, and who would like to see a greater economic and social integration in the Arab world that would bring the Arab peoples closer together, and who believe that there are reasons for why the Arabs ought to feel and be closer together than they have been.
Is Pan-Arabism, in a way, a reaction to the colonialism after World War I, when the victors of World War I, France and England, redrew the map of the Middle East and divided it up between themselves?
Historians have long debated the issue of whether Arab nationalism is fundamentally a negative idea or does it have any positive merits in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly would agree with historians who believe that Arab nationalism at different times has been a negative idea in the sense of an idea of opposition to forces that are stronger and that come from the outside that attempt to control and divide the Arab peoples from one another. But there is also a sentiment that is very hard to bottle or capture, but it is there. And I think anyone who has spent time in the Arab world studying Arab society would notice, and that is despite all the divisions, political, territorial, frontiers, economic divisions between rich and poor, there is a sentiment which is very much focused on a single language, Arabic, and on a system of cultural ideas that are connected in large part to Islam, but which are not exclusively Islamic, that many Arabs feel. They may not be able to articulate this sentiment in a systematic kind of way, and that has been perhaps the problem with Pan-Arabism or Pan-Arab nationalism. But it is a sentiment that many Arabs feel, and one feels it when one travels across these various borders from one Arab country to the next. Whether that idea has served the higher interests of the Arab people, whether it has actually ever come into greater realization, has it been used successfully by the people to achieve their ends, I would have to say so far, no, it hasn't. The idea has not worked. And many scholars have argued that we really ought to talk about the end of Pan-Arabism. And in a sense, Pan-Arabism died its death back in the 1970s. And there may be some credibility to that kind of argument. But it is in times like this where the crisis that we're witnessing is so powerful that that idea may rear its head. It may come up to the surface. And I think we may be witnessing, I can't vouch for it, but we may be witnessing a recrudescence of pan-Arabism. But one would also have to say that it is expressed, at least in part, in the negative terms that are so traditional to that part of the world, in the sense of being a way of opposing Western control, Western imperial interests, the United States in particular, maybe Israel. And there may be also a positive sense to it, in the sense that Arabs are dissatisfied with the tyrannical governments that they live under and may try to use the opportunities being created by this conflict to challenge the regimes that have dominated society for so long in such an unpositive way.
How do you think Saddam Hussein is using the concept of Arab unity, pan-Arabism?
Well, he's using it to elicit as much reaction of a positive kind for himself and his regime as he possibly can. He is appealing to the long-held Arab desire for greater economic integration in that part of the world and for a better, more equitable redistribution of resources, transferring from the small number of very wealthy oil producers some or a great deal of what is being produced there to a much poorer, wider Arab world. And that resonates with pan-Arab ideas very, very clearly. And as I said, as an opportunist, he is taking advantage of this sentiment. He understands it, and he's playing it so far quite successfully that I can't say, and I think it would be a mistake to say, that he has succeeded yet in rallying the Arab masses behind him, though he may have that opportunity still.
Isn't it one of the ultimate acts of hypocrisy to talk about Arab unity at the same time you invade an Arab state?
Well, it is one of the great contradictions. The Arab peoples may not be as naive as some attribute them, claim them to be. That they may be wishing to take advantage of the circumstances created by Saddam Hussein to achieve some of their other ends. And it may not have anything or very little to do with a real deep-seated feeling of trust and confidence in him as a leader or in Iraq as the new dominant Arab, future dominant Arab society if Iraq is to triumph in this war. So I think one ought to be cautious there and realize that the Arabs have many agendas and they have different kinds of priorities. And if they see Saddam Hussein and Iraq shaking up their part of the world, perhaps turning it upside down, perhaps that's all they would expect of him. And if it works to their advantage, if it allows them to correct some of the injustices they feel have been committed against them by their own rulers, by the West, by others, well, then one can say that they would find what he has done appropriate up to a certain limit. But yes, of course, the contradiction is there. And no one understands this or feels this perhaps more strongly than those Palestinian elites who have in recent days been criticizing the PLO for, on one hand, opposing all occupations, forced occupations of territory, such as Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, at the same time that the PLO has basically supported Saddam Hussein and has not been critical of Iraq's occupation of another people's territory. So the contradiction is there for everyone to see, and we haven't seen how these contradictions yet will play themselves out. And that's what we're all watching very, very closely. But the Middle East is full of these kinds of contradictions, and this isn't the first time that we've seen them rise to the surface.
I think a lot of Americans feel a sense of a historical hostility directed at them by many residents of Arab countries and don't really understand why. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think are some of the legitimate historical grievances that the Arab world has against the United States?
Well, the Arab world's main historical grievance against the United States. Here one must differentiate the United States from Britain and France. The United States has never been a colonial power. power in the Middle East, though some are arguing that it may have to become one as a result of the crisis it faces today in the Persian Gulf region. But the major point of contention in the Arab world, and it is not the only point, but the major point is the issue of the Palestinians and of some resolution of this nagging, lingering conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis. The belief, and I think this can be felt at the very top of Arab society, and it reaches way down into the lower rungs of Arab society, a belief that the largest, the world's most important democratic power, and certainly the strongest power on the face of this earth, has not been even-handed in its dealings between the Arabs and the Israelis over the question of occupied territories and Palestinian national sovereignty. And I think this is a question that if you scratched any Arab, in fact, you wouldn't have to scratch them. All you'd have to do is ask them. They would respond that this is an issue in which the United States has been neglectful and has not really done what it should do as the world's most important power.
On American TV, you watch Saddam Hussein. He looks like, he almost looks like he was sent by central casting as a dictator. Do you know what I mean? There's something just very obvious about that. And yet he seems to really have a popular following among certain Arabs. Can you explain why he is popular with the people he is popular with?
Yes, I think it would be a mistake to exaggerate his personal popular following in the Arab world. As I said, he is an opportunist who is playing on a strong series or set of resentments among people in the Arab world at a time when no leaders in the Arab world have emerged to stand up and at least lay claim to being in a position to correct all the years of abuse and disgruntled feeling and resentment against the West and against their own Arab rulers. But at the same time, one should also recognize that people in the Arab world understand that Saddam Hussein is that individual who launched a war against Iran in 1980 that led to 1 million casualties or more on both sides, on the Iranian and the Iraqi side, which helped to bring the Iraqi economy down to its knees, which in a sense destroyed the very foundations of a society and of an entity that really did have a future. Iraq, with strong agriculture and with a lot of oil wealth, had a real promising future. And that war, one can't help but recall, was a war in which Iraq ended up in, though winning the war was a Pyrrhic victory by all standards, and it was not a situation that the Arabs were particularly happy about.
It strikes me that I haven't witnessed a strong, unified movement of Arab intellectual dissidents who are exiles from dictatorships in the Arab world and who really identify with Arab culture, perhaps identify with Islam, but vocally disassociate themselves from the political dictatorships of some of those countries. I wonder if you think that's an accurate observation, and if so, what you think some of the reasons behind that might be.
No, I think that is, up until very recently, quite an accurate description. One should recall that the Arab secular elites, the intelligentsia in the Arab world, highly educated in the 1950s and 60s, made a very hard decision, which was to support the new radicalized states that were emerging in Egypt, in Syria, and Iraq, to support these states which claimed that true justice could only come through economic prosperity for the peoples of the Arab world. And by standing back or supporting these regimes, they basically closed their eyes to the growing reality that these regimes had no interest in developing democratic structures and processes in these various states. And so the intelligentsia, though there are exceptions here, the intelligentsia, by and large, went along with the military rulers and civilian radical leaders in the Arab world who were saying, we'll come to democracy, but only after we achieve some level of economic and social prosperity for our peoples. And by basically standing back and accepting this model, which has a model which, of course, is very familiar to those people who live in Eastern Europe and who live through the last 30 or 40 years of the socialist dictatorships in Eastern Europe, will understand. So the intellectuals or the intelligentsia basically compromised their role as intellectuals or members of the intelligentsia, and they lost power as a result. In the last few years, before Saddam Hussein did what he did in Kuwait, there has been a noticeable growing movement in certain Arab countries led by intellectuals, both secular and Islamic in orientation, toward the development of democratic institutions in their societies. And this is probably the most encouraging thing we have seen. In part, it is spurred on by what the Arab intellectuals have noticed in Eastern Europe, what they see going on around them elsewhere in the world. This movement has not come all the way around. It has not come fully to fruition. It is unclear whether it will succeed. It is a weak movement, but it is a movement or a trend that experts have begun to notice. Whether it will succeed or not, I think we don't know. And what Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi war with the United States will do to improve or accelerate that movement, I cannot tell you. But there are many in the Arab world, among intellectuals I talk to in these days, who believe that it may open up some new opportunities for individuals and groups in society who have been disenfranchised or alienated to better challenge their autocratic regimes.
Philip Khoury is a professor of Middle East history at MIT. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.